Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good morning. I'm Richard Adie. You're on ABC Radio National. Welcome to Life Matters. Hope you had a good Easter weekend. Today, why it's important that we don't sugarcoat stories for teenagers and women in the new economy. You'll be hearing about that with Anne Mann a bit later. Firstly, what have been the most important decisions in your life? If you think about it, a couple of things rear their heads pretty quickly. Who you're with. Most of us want to be with someone. Who that person is and what they're like have a big impact on everything else. Also, what you do. That has a massive effect too. And not just in terms of how much people are paid, though obviously that's important. It also affects how happy we are. If you're in, say, marketing, but you really want to be a teacher, you probably aren't that happy with your life. So who you're with and what you do are enormously important. My first guest today would add another key decision, where you live. His name's Richard Florida. You might remember him as the thinker behind the book The Rise of the Creative Class. He's written another one now called Who's Your City? His city's Toronto, and he joins me on the line now. Richard, welcome to Life Matters. Why do you think place is so important?
Well, good day, Richard. You know, after I wrote Rise of the Creative Class, well, I came to Australia 3 or 4 times. I've traveled around the world and actually moved twice. And I said to myself, you know, I've been a professor of geography and urban planning for more than 20 years. And mayors find the book exciting and economic development officials and civic leaders find the book exciting. But no one has ever written a book for the tens of millions of people who actually make a decision to relocate each year. So I said, that's what I should do. I should write a book for just regular people who are deciding to move and help them better frame that choice and hopefully better understand that choice and ultimately find a place or community that fits them well and they can be happy in.
But why is it as important, say, as who you're with or what you do?
Well, it was quite striking to me that, you know, Dan Gilbert wrote an amazing book, and he called it Stumbling on Happiness. He's a psychologist at Harvard. And he said, we make 3 important decisions in our life. What we do for a living, who we pick as our life partner, and where we live. And in that whole book, and in every other book on happiness or on our lives, people talk about the first 2 decisions, the what you do and the who you marry. And not just in academic work, you know, if we're in high school and we're growing up, we have guidance counselors, and our parents kind of tell us, and there's articles on what careers are great careers. And if we're thinking about getting married or finding that special someone, there's all sorts of books on psychology and advice columnists. No one has ever addressed this issue of where we live. And why do I think it's one of the 3 critical decisions, and why do I think it's even more important than the other 2? It's because where we live increasingly will determine the kinds of labor markets and job markets we have access to. And the second thing is it also determines if we're single and want to get married, where the people we would like might be. And if we have a family and are raising kids, the place we choose to live is going to have a big effect on our family life and how our kids, you know, the schools and the quality of life our families have. So it's as important, if not more important, and I think certainly more important, the most important decision we make.
Because for a while, there was this mantra about the death of distance, that place just didn't matter.
Well, you know, I grew up with that, and there have been a whole series of writings about the death of distance, the end of place. This book by Thomas Friedman, The World is Flat, and you know, it's not just with the internet. You know, it's going back to when we invented the streetcar and the train and the automobile and then the airplane and then the fax machine. There's always been this sense that we're going to escape place. But what I discovered in this book and in doing my research is, if you think about this, this year is the first time in history, according to the United Nations, more than half of us live in urban centers. And obviously in Australia, such a large share of your population live in the 4 or 5 or 6 major urban centers. But even more than that, we actually looked at the images of the world at night, those light maps of the world at night with the black sky and the glistening lights. And we used a variety of techniques, but what we figured out is that there are 40 mega regions that kind of drive the world economy. They contain about 18% of the world's population, but they produce more than two-thirds of our economic output and about 9 in 10 of our innovations. So in a sense, the world isn't just getting flatter. It's actually getting more concentrated. And what I call these mega regions and mega cities are becoming the driving forces of our world economy.
Yeah, actually reading the book, it's not only clear that some cities are overwhelmingly important. I mean, you don't have to read the book to know that New York and London and Tokyo are incredibly important places. You actually explain why they're important.
Yeah, well, you know, jobs and economic activity are concentrating in places. If you want to understand where economic growth comes from, it comes from the clustering of people in cities. That's really the wellspring of our economic well-being. And then it goes on to say, not only are our jobs becoming concentrated, if you want to be an actor, you have to live in Los Angeles or maybe Sydney or Wellington, New Zealand. If you want to be a musician, increasingly that kind of thing happens in Nashville and London and a few other places around the world. If you want to be a software engineer, you've got to be in a high-tech area like the Silicon Valley. But the second point the book makes is that if you want to be happy in your life, what we found is that if you want to really have a fulfilled life and be happy, it really depends on where you live, that the place we live is something that can give us incredible joy in our lives.
And part of that is that you have found that cities and places have personalities. Now, why is that?
Well, you know, I'm a very fortunate person, and I met a young psychologist at Cambridge University in the United Kingdom named Jason Renfro. Jason had been studying how you can look at somebody's iPod or look at their music collection and basically read their personality. Well, I sent him an email, and I said, Jason, have you ever thought about looking at personality and where we live? And he wrote me back, he said, you know, Rich, I've just begun to think about that. So he had information on a sample of 650,000 people. And what we found initially, just doing this for the United States, in the future, hopefully we'll do it for Australia and the rest of the world, that there are five types of personalities. There are agreeable people, conscientious people, extroverted people, they like other people a lot. There are neurotic people, and there are open to experience people. And that these personality types live in different areas. And the open to experience people, the ones that like a lot of experiential stimulation, they're highly creative, they form their own companies, they're the ones that tend to migrate to these kind of urban hotspots, whether that's Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane or another major kind of creative center. And what we're finding is it's not just talented and highly educated people that are migrating. It's a particular personality type. And I find that part of the book in many ways to be the biggest learning. I wrote this in the book, Richard. I said, all my life I've been kind of an economic determinist. You know, I've read Adam Smith and Karl Marx. Mm. I should have paid a lot more attention to Sigmund Freud. And one of the things I say in the book is that cities have their own psychology and personality, and that urban leaders and mayors and people have to pay a lot more attention to that, because if the city doesn't fit your personality, you're just not going to be happy there.
Some of it was, I guess, predictable. New York turns out to be the most neurotic place in America, but I didn't know about Chicago being perhaps the most extroverted.
You know, and it's interesting, we have two maps in the book. We have the map of the personalities, and in that map, you know, you can't overlay them in a book, but you could do it in a computer. The extroverts are all in Chicago. Well, guess what is the number one occupation in Chicago? Salespeople. Like, it makes perfect intuitive sense that the extroverted people will be fantastic at sales. And then the other one are, of course, flight attendants, who also are kind of highly extroverted. So the economic map and the personality map, not in every instance, but in many instances, seem like they go together.
And the other things that track together were the two of the personality traits, agreeableness and conscientiousness.
Yes, we found in our country, in the United States, and again, we really want to do this for the rest of the world, and Jason convinces me sooner or later we'll have the data from these surveys. But the, you know, the conscientious and agreeable people are really in those old, they called it the Midwest, or sometimes people call them the flyover states, but they kind of run from kind of Cleveland and Detroit in the middle of the United States and on down to what they call the Sun Belt, the kind of Atlantas and Georgias and all of this. And what happens, I think, is the agreeable and conscientious people that are really the backbone of a workforce, very dutiful, very easy to get along with and work in teams, they kind of cluster together in these old industrial centers, we're kind of the open to experience people, the highly experiential people. They want a lot of stimulation. They want to go over off the Greenwich Villages in New York City. They want to go out to the San Franciscos. They want to go to the Los Angeles. They'd be the people who go to kind of inner city Melbourne or Sydney. And they kind of are the people who are almost like pinpoints on the maps. Not surprisingly, those are the areas that you get a lot of new companies formed. You get a lot of innovation. You get a lot of musical creativity, a lot of artistic creativity. And really, it's not simply the economic base. It's also this kind of psychological mapping that plays a key role.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Richard Florida, who's one of the world's leading thinkers about urban studies and human geography. He's at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto and author, among other things, of his latest, Who's Your City? One of the keys in the book, Richard, is that we're looking for different things in a place to live at different times in our life.
You know, and it's important to say that you mentioned Toronto and the Rotman School. We just moved here. My ideal life would be to spend our summer in North America and your summer in Sydney or another great, you know, I love Australia. Yeah, we said that people make three big decisions. And if you think about that, if you're listening in, you make three big decisions to move in your life. The first one you make is kind of when you graduate college or university, and you're thinking about, you know, what am I going to do for a job? Where am I going to find my life partner? What kind of community do I need to be in at that stage? And then the next one you make is not when you get married. It's really when the kids come along, and you're thinking about, you know, what's going to be best for myself and my family and my kids. And the third big decision that comes along is when the kids leave the house. Each of those three stages, don't just move around the corner. Don't just move to a suburb. You owe it to yourself to give this a lot of thought, you know, and think about your career, think about your lifestyle, think about the psychological factors, think about communities. You owe it to yourself not just to move down the street or to the close-by suburb. You owe it to yourself to really take a long, hard look. And you know, Richard, what I always say is, when you go out and look for your job and your career, you go through an assessment. You look at the company. You go to interviews. You talk to a wide variety of people. Why don't we put a fraction of the thought that we do for our job and our life mates into the place we choose to live? And if we did, we'd find we could make a better decision at each of those stages, young and single, when the kids are around and when the kids are gone. We'd make a better decision and we'd have a better life.
But, I mean, people like to stay near friends and family, especially if they've, say, moved to one place in that early part of their lives just after university, and then they get to the next stage with the kids and they find themselves in a different city to their parents and the rest of their family.
Well, the most controversial study that I talk about in the book, and, you know, just over the Easter holiday, we were home. My wife's family lives in Greater Detroit, so we went to visit. And if we really want to get a great conversation started, I talk about this study. There's an economist in England who did a study, and he found that for each family member and friend you leave behind, you sacrifice about $100,000, give or take some money, $100,000 for each family and friend member you leave behind. And I say, my wife, who left behind two parents and five siblings, I'm an awfully big debt with her. And, of course, then the conversation rages. How could you put a price tag on family and friends? And is this guy crazy? But the point is, people have to be aware of it. And in order for us to drive our careers forward, you know, think about it. You're born in Perth or Adelaide, Brisbane, and the career you want happens to be in Sydney or in Melbourne. Well, what do you do? You know, do you move for that career, and does that career pull you away? Or do you stay near families and friends and try to find another job option? But one of the things, you know, we're finding, of course, is that many people in Australia, and we know this because Australians travel so much more even than North Americans, so many people in Australia are looking at our part of the world, and so many people in our part of the world are looking at places not only in North America, but in Europe and in Asia. And so what it says to people is, you know, don't just confine your options to the ones in your home country. Think broadly.
You call some of the places that you talk about superstar cities, and one of the key indicators is real estate's always more expensive in those places. Given that place is so important and that you think people ought to move to be happy and productive, one of the things you identify is that home ownership can get in the way of that.
Well, Richard, two things there. The one thing we say, and I know this because I think Australia has a higher rate of home ownership even than the American. So you're kind of the ownership society. One of the things the book says is sometimes people get into this mindset where they say, I'm going to move and find a city that's affordable. I'm going to move out of Sydney and move to a smaller town because I can buy more house. We say that's all well and fine, and that may be your best decision, but realize that an apartment or house in a Sydney or a New York City or a London has historically appreciated at such a rate. If it's the biggest investment decision we make, treat it like an investment. Just don't look for the cheapest price to get in. Look at how it's going to grow over time in those superstar cities, the Londons, the Hong Kongs, the Sydneys, the New Yorks and San Franciscos have that quality. The second thing I say that's really important, and now more and more people are kind of taking note of this, in this idea-driven creative economy that we live in, where mobility is so darn important, the book has a whole chapter which says increasingly our economic mobility hinges on our geographic mobility. Sometimes, and now in the United States, we have this terrible housing crisis and credit crisis. I mean, if we're stuck with a house we can't sell and the job opportunities are in another city, we're kind of in the hole. Maybe it's time that we rethink home ownership a little. And I'll tell you, this has begun a dialogue right here in the States. People are now beginning to say it may make a lot more sense in certain times of your life to be a renter, postpone home ownership, especially if you have to be mobile, put your money in a nice set of investments, and don't jump in, because you can get in a situation where your need to move for work is impeded. You know, it's hindered. You can't do it because you own a house that you can't sell.
Richard, this is fascinating, but this particular idea would take us another half hour, and we really don't have the time. We've just scratched the surface. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Richard, and I just want to say hi to all our friends in Australia, and like I said, I mean, my dream life someday, when I get a little bit older, will be to spend half the year here in North America and half the year over with you, and I think you know, the concepts in this book apply doubly and triply for Australians.
Richard Florida is Professor of Business and Creativity at Toronto University's Rotman School of Management and the founder of the Creative Class Group. And Hoosier City is published by Basic Books, and we'd like to know what you think too. Why don't you jump on our website and get on the guest book, or send us an email from there, and that is abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. We'll also link to Richard's websites. You can find them there too. And coming up next on Life Matters, women, caring and respecting choice.
Hello, I'm Michael McKenzie, and on Bush Telegraph, when life gives you a plague of camels in the central part of this country, there's only one thing to do.
It's in a big chunk now. Do you have to stripe through a mincer?
Yeah, we'll cut it up into little bits. It's pretty fatty sort of stuff, so we get a nice oily sausage and a bit of flavour, and then we'll cut it up into little bits and put it through the mincer three times, mixing our meal and water in as we go.
One hump or two. Bush Telegraph, this morning after the news at 11 on ABC Radio National.
Get to work. That's the new mantra for women, regardless of their roles as mothers. And it concerns writer Anne Mann. She's written the latest quarterly essay called Love and Money, the Family and the Free Market. And she joins me now. And welcome to Life Matters. Now, Therese Raine, who's married to our Prime Minister, made you feel, I think, temporarily optimistic about women's roles.
Yes, I was very interested when he was shaping up to be the leader of the opposition, then became leader of the opposition, to see how he related to women. And it seemed to me that he represented both a new style and old style family man. And then I was really struck by how when he did become leader of the opposition, the Rudd's domestic life became the focus of national attention. And in one particular case, he made a gaffe, you know, he made a mistake when he said something about women, that he had a very independent wife who was a very successful businesswoman, but she did not want to have the role of a dependent appendage, you know, to a man. And this immediately caused a lot of outcry for the very interesting reason that while we no longer have a old-fashioned universal pattern of breadwinner, husband and homemaker wife, we have not replaced that with just one version of the modern power couple with both people working full-time. We've got a whole diversity of choices and decisions which are made, and everyone's doing it differently. So he'd really, just for a moment, put his foot in it. But then he recovered himself, I thought, very deftly and very cleverly by speaking with such respect both for her role as a worker, you know, as a person who's passionate about helping unemployed people get back into the workforce, but also as a mother, that she'd spent quite a bit of time at home with her children.
Mm.
So that just for once you didn't have this sense that there were just two camps of people and you're in one or the other and of necessity denigrating one. Instead, you had a sense that work and family life might be more easily integrated and that both aspects of life were to be valued.
It was more nuanced altogether, wasn't it?
Exactly. It was a much more nuanced approach, and I thought it was a fresh way of looking at it.
But you are concerned that their particular scenario is very rare, and I don't mean by that, you know, a prime minister married to enormously successful businesswoman.
No, but the way it was put, both respect for the private realm, because they spoke how much they about how much they respected those parents at home juggling children and all of that, but they also spoke with passion about work. So that is very different to what I normally read. And in the essay, I talk about a piece of work which was called Get to Work, a Manifesto for Women of the World, published by an American feminist. And it came out of an article in American Prospect the year before, which attacked not just women at home looking after children, but women who were shaping their life around children, working part-time or working from home, anything other than the full tilt career path as soon as your child's born and out of the womb, you have to be back at work. And she described those who did shape their life around children as living a lesser life, to quote, and voluntarily joining a caste of untouchables who were preoccupying themselves with, you know, removing human waste and you know, cleaning, you know, the mess around the house and so on. So that was my contrast to the note of optimism, which I struck at the beginning of the essay. And then I went on to say that the get-to-work mantra that Hirschman puts forward, although it is very virulently and contemptuously put in her arguments, nonetheless, it's actually not that far distant to a lot of our government reports, to our political parties, to the general sentiment about where women are at and where they should go. So, in fact, they're more polite about it, and they claim that it's in all women's interests, that, you know, this is what women want to do, so all we're doing is helping them. But nonetheless, the get-to-work idea is now at the centre of how we think about women.
One of your concerns is that the choice issue has been skewered. It used to be women couldn't work even if they wanted to. Now they're more compelled to.
Yes, precisely. And what I'm showing in the essay is that because historically women were prevented from working, we've been rather slow, I think, to realise that things now have changed and that the new political orthodoxy, which gives women as little room to move in a way, is to do with them getting to work. And it is really just as much a need of our economy which is driving all of this.
Yes.
And it's to do with falling fertility. You know, with falling fertility, for example, when people have fewer children, there are far more dependents, that is, you know, older people and children, those who are sick and so on, who need to be supported by an ever-shrinking workforce. So this has promoted a very widespread concern on the part of government to get more and more people into the workforce. And then you're thinking about, well, who is not presently working or who is not working enough? And then you're looking at all of these groups, including mothers. Now, one of the important things here is I'm not at all arguing that where women want to work, they ought not. And in fact, in the essay, I put forward a wide range of proposals which would make the possibility of reconciling motherhood with work much easier. My concern is that this should be under women's own autonomy.
That is your whole point. Yeah, yes. The issue of choice and nuanced choice. But, I mean, you're talking about the big picture end of it and the bit that economists talk about with participation along with population and productivity, mm. about pushing the economy up.
Mm.
But if you're a woman with young children, you might like to possibly stay home for longer. But from your point of view, it's economically, for most people, just not possible.
Yes, well, we now face a real housing crisis. And we've had for some time, you know, one of the aspects of the new economy is high levels of indebtedness, high levels of consumption, a bidding war, really, over housing, which has pushed up the price of a really essential part of most family life. So it is really imperative that we consider ways that we can support people to do what most of them, clearly showing preference opinion polls, want to do, and that is stay home for a bit longer. For example, there was a poll commissioned around paid maternity leave, and it was done by the National Federation of Women and also the National Investment for the Early Years and the New South Wales Commissioner for Young People and for Children and Young People, and also the Queensland equivalent body. And they found something like over 90% of people thought that it was essential for parents to spend more time with a baby and that women were forced back into the workforce too early. And over 70% supported the idea of paid leave, which is a policy which is embraced in Northern Europe and in Britain and in Canada. So that, you know, here we have a mismatch, if you like. I was really struck by one comment in The Age just coming into the election, and it said that it looked like both parties wanted women to get back to work as soon as possible after childbirth. And the commentator said, well, and I'm pretty sure that's what women want as well. But then you look at a poll like this and you realise that actually there's a huge disparity between the preferences of not just women but men, fathers as well, and where policy seems to be headed.
On Life Matters today, my guest is the writer Anne Mann, and we're talking about her quarterly essay, which is Love and Money, the Family and Free Market. This is fundamentally all about women's choices, particularly in regard to their lives when they have young children. You mentioned maternity leave, and I've written about maternity leave myself, so I won't take you up on that. But if we put that to one side, enormous as it is, aren't there sufficient policy options for women who want more time at home with their babies? There's the baby bonus, paid to everyone, currently being tinkered with, but continuing. And there's Family Tax Benefit B, which helps families where the mother is not in paid work.
Yes, the problem with that is that it was brought in by the previous government. And what I'm looking at in this essay is a moment in history where we are poised to head, I think, in a very different direction. And I'm not at all sure how far those kinds of benefits are going to remain. And one of the really crucial benefits, which seems to me to do something much more than the baby bonus, which is a longer period of parental leave, but which gives you the right to return to your previous job, which is essentially the kinds of policies which are embraced in Northern Europe, that we are potentially likely to move away from policies like that and instead embrace an early return to work more along the American model, where in fact they have only 3 months of unpaid leave and they more or less have to get back to work after that point. So,
do you really think that's more likely now? I would have thought that it was less likely than it has been for 10 years.
Well, I think that if you look at, I'm not saying this is an eventuality, but you know that is one of the reasons for my quarterly essay. It's an intervention to say, come on, let's have a look at the kinds of rhetoric, the kinds of casual and easy assumptions about where women's interests lie, and trying to galvanise a certain attention, you know, to this issue, and making sure that we realise that these forms of choice are not necessarily guaranteed to us, and that we need to see that they're valuable, we need to see that they need to be defended, and they need to be seen as essential to any modern political life. If you look at, as I show in the essay, publications coming out of the OECD, the World Bank, out of IMF, if you look at many, many government statements on across the world on these issues, the get-to-work mantra is very deeply entrenched, and the assumption seems to be invariably that both women and children's interests, you know, lie in women getting back to work early and going into childcare. So that I don't see as guaranteed at all the option of a well-protected, well-supported choice.
There are several issues surrounding work, and I want to come back to them, but I want to ask you about another report that you do talk about in the essay, and that's the one from Relationships Australia, which it says the reality of many people's lives is a tragedy, and it's a word that I think is used quite deliberately in terms of the hours worked and the time spent with children.
Yes. Well, that was a very interesting report because one of the strange conundrums during the Howard era was an attempt to both support the single-income family and traditional families, but at the same time having a very freewheeling free market economy. And what the Relationships Australia report shows is that there was a real conflict between those aims. And in fact, people began to work longer hours. We had something like 20% of people working over 50 hours, one of the longest in the OECD countries.
They have now peaked. I think it was 2002. They got to be as high as they were going to get, and they've dropped a tiny bit.
But still, that's a very high percentage. And if you contrast it with Finland and Sweden, there's only about 5% of those who are working those long hours. Now, they're often partnered by people who are also working longer hours and also atypical hours, so on Saturdays and in evenings and in mornings when you're trying to get children off to childcare and so on. And what they found, that there was an impact on both the parenting and their relationships. And they were raising the very important question, which is not raised at all by the get-to-work mantra, which is exactly how do you balance those fundamental family responsibilities with an increased workforce participation, not just of one parent, but of both parents.
Your fundamental concern is what happens to parenting, isn't it?
Yes.
Motherhood in particular, I think.
Well, both, actually. For example, when you sanctify work, when you create it as a new sacred, when it is enchanted, which is the term I use in the
work.
Essay.
Yes,
it's a kind of enchanted value for us. We don't question it much. There's a book with a title which sums this up beautifully called Better Than Sex, How a Whole Generation Got Hooked on Work. And if you look at those kinds of values, then how on earth do you really change male behaviour around parenting and fathering? It's very difficult for men who want to be involved parents to be supported in that when they are cast as failures unless they're successful at work. And we seem to be moving to a position where women too are in the position where they may feel failures unless they're at work. I've been really struck as I've moved around doing the publicity for this essay by the numbers of young women who will come and either say to me that their partner or husband would love to spend more time with their children but is absolutely unsupported by his workplace and would be regarded as an unserious player if he cut back at all, or alternatively, that they have made the decision to cut back or to go out of the workforce for a time, but although they are certain that this is right for them and their child at the moment, nonetheless feel a real identity crisis around it because so much value is placed on paid work and the identity of the worker.
And they've spent the first, perhaps, 30 years of their lives being told they can be all they can be and go to university and achieve just as much as men. This is all good.
Mm.
And then they find that actually there's a price to be paid. And that's a big part of your point. We'll wrap up on that in a moment. Just before we do, though, what about the argument that the world of work can in fact make for happier parents? They might be tired, they might be stressed and stretched, but they also might get things they need from work, like social contact and sense of accomplishment, and that happiness, happier parents make for happier children.
Yes. Well, I actually don't dismiss that at all. I'm not here arguing against work. You must understand that. I'm saying that we must much better integrate work with family. I think that for some people, what you're saying is undoubtedly true, that they find work enormously stimulating. I think there is a difference between the upper echelon of workers and the vast bulk of workers. I make the point in the essay that there are those who really do live to work and those who work in order to live, and I think we need to keep that in mind. However, there are many positive aspects to work. I really enjoy my work, always have, so that this is not a kind of anti-work argument, if you like. It is rather that we need to pay heed to the very important principle that it should be up to the parents and the mothers themselves to make the choices that they need and to find the balances that they need and to respect the unpaid caregiving work that they do, rather than simply valuing their paid work.
You want a lot changed, and towards the end of the essay you're quite prescriptive, and this essay does concentrate on the issues surrounding young children. But fundamentally you say that there won't be equality until women no longer have to make impossible choices.
Yes. And I also say we won't have equality until we create a new social imagination around the question of care. That is, that we actually value it as much as we value paid work. And so that what I'm arguing for in the essay, because I talk about things like elder care as well and care for the disabled and many other aspects of care, it is really essential that we understand that none of those parts of life are going to go away, and they simply can't be marginalised as they have been by workers when they have had a wife at home to do it all for them. They're going to be at the forefront of all workers' lives now, and we need to consider that.
And it's a long essay. We've only been able to touch upon parts of it, but thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you, Richard.
Anne Mann, author of the latest quarterly essay, which is called Love and Money, the Family and the Free Market. What do you think? Have you felt the pressure to get to work, perhaps before you were really ready to do so? Drop us a line via the email or the guest book. That's at abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. You could also maybe jump on our listener line, 2028334030. Very keen to get your feedback on this. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National.
Believe me, oh, believe me, oh, believe me, believe me, oh, believe me, oh, believe me.
Ooh. With a voice like that, I've got to believe that Shelby Lynn's new CD, Just a Little Lovin', tribute to Dusty Springfield, is a beautiful thing. She stripped back all those huge productions to make a nice showcase for a beautiful voice. It's our feature disc on the Daily Planet, which happens every weekday at 2:20 and weeknights at 11:20, right here on ABC Radio National.
Have you ever played the pokies? I've done it once, lost $10, never again. But a lot of Australians do this. In fact, our national love affair with the one-armed bandits is well documented. We have one of the highest concentrations of poker machines in the world. Melbourne writer Hazel Edwards recently conducted an experiment with the pokies, and the results were quite surprising.
I've become addicted to pokies players. The female mass lecturer was the first to intrigue me. I just like to take $20, have a glass of wine, and chill out as I play the pokies. It's my time. I invest $50, said another, because I don't smoke or drink. At that stage, I thought they were fooling themselves. Even the word invest or gaming was self-delusion. I like maths, and I'm persistent, which is possibly the worst attribute for a losing gambler. But I'm intrigued by whether addiction is different from curiosity as a motive, and decided to conduct a gambling experiment on myself across this last year. I started with a kitty of $100 in January to see how much I had left at the end. I kept a separate purse. At odd moments, when I was in an area for work, I started playing 1 cent machines. Then I realised the 5 cent paid better, but 2 cents was more manageable within my budget. So I'd start on the 2 cents, and if I won anything, would move to 5 cents. There were others like me, respectable and with the atmosphere of free coffee and attentive service. Madam was seductive. Expensive free coffees and snacks. Players or gamblers seem to fall into categories. The suits, who feed in $50 notes, hit the 20 lines and lost or won fast in minutes and walked away. The pensioners, or those with the little money, who played the 1 cent but who ended up losing. The stupids, who played randomly, lost a lot, and who voiced their theories for winning systems. Others calculate the odds. There's a small group who appear to play as a mathematical challenge, realising the machines are programmed to respond to changes in patterns, so they play small and then go up high occasionally and may manage to trigger a payout. Few walk away. They pay back with increasingly high denominations. A few use the pokies as a distractor from personal tragedy, like those pokies situated near cancer hospitals. Some players are in wheelchairs, look pale, or are disabled in other ways. I learnt to read the gamers. The couples on a date, taking turns to press the button. The lonely males, often divorced, or on-call tradies, on the pickup. Their odds of a pickup line were better than winning from the gambling. Their motivations fascinate because I like to know why a person acts in that way. So I chatted to those alongside, if they were receptive. The self-employed are gamblers in the sense that only about 1 in 10 projects get up. The odds are even worse on the pokies' machines. So why, as a self-employed person, have I become hooked on the players' motivations, as much as the pokies? Curiosity or addiction? Governments have vested interest in taxes from pokies. Local clubs rely on the income and ignore the individual addictions. The pokies' music, lights and pseudo-colourful stories create a temple to gambling, especially when coupled with solicitous attendants trained at Smile School. The dangers were if I stayed and played for over an hour at even low amounts, my concentration waned and I upped the ante. Suddenly, the 20-cent bets just seemed like a different kind of button that had no connection with reality. When others slid more notes in beside me, I felt superior that I wasn't hooked like that. The first time I broke a $10 note was significant. The machines and the ladies' toilets contain warnings about gambling becoming a problem and a phone number to call. All are ignored, even by those on self-exclusion. Well, it's a gamble, and I'm in front, just. But the real test is whether I can leave now. My research is complete and my script performed and my story published. My real discovery is that gamblers like to lose, or at least to experience the heart-stopping exhilaration that they might. After a year, how much did I have left from my $100? Well, I won a jackpot of $210.30, so I'm in front by $10.30. Yes, I did lose extra earlier, but I can afford that. Self-delusion? Maybe.
Hazel Edwards. And after that participation observation research, Hazel's story, Making a Killing at the Pokies, is in the Short and Twisted anthology. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. And coming up next, our Meet the Listener guest, a voracious reader, all thanks to his father. This week's Meet the Listener guest is Carl Andrew, and if you're having trouble getting your children to read, perhaps you can do what Carl's father did. What began with a puffin paperback has had a lifelong effect. Welcome to Life Matters, Carl.
Thank you, Richard.
Now, let's go back to one evening in the late 1940s. I think your dad arriving home from work. What happened?
Well, he came back from town one Friday evening, and gave me a book, a small book, a puffin novel, as opposed to a picture book. My sister and I had been very well supplied with kids' picture books, of course, as, you know, hundreds of them, and we loved them, and our parents would read to these from us, and we loved the stories and the pictures. But there's a big move, I think, in going from picture books to just the written word on the page. And the puffin kids' novels were really without illustrations. There may have been a little black and white drawing here and there, but when you looked at the book, it was just printed words, and I think that's a big transition. So Dad brought back this book. I was 8. I remember it was called Muazzuk. It was a translation of a Russian kids' novel about a wild Siberian cat. And there were no pictures, apart from a little illustration on the cover. And so I embarked on reading this and read it in some days, and I remember that I greatly enjoyed it. So next Friday, my father came back with another book, and quite a different sort of story, and I read it. And then he said, well, what I'm going to do is I'll buy you a children's novel every Friday, forever and ever, as long as you read the one I've given you by the following Thursday. So, of course, I had a huge incentive to make sure I got through that book.
And you took up the challenge.
I did indeed, with eagerness, and it meant I got 52 books a year. And over the years, these accrued, and they became a very proud possession. And our parents would have dinner guests. I'd drag them in and show them my my mounting collection of books. And I loved adding each new book to the shelf.
Oh, but how long did you keep this up for, Carl?
Well, I can't quite remember. Dad kept on supplying the books for years, but of course, for birthdays and Christmas, I always said I wanted money, and I'd go then and buy books myself, select them, and I think it petered out when eventually I was getting enough pocket money to be able to afford to go and select the books I wanted from. So it kind of, rather than stopping at a certain date, I think it just sort of died a natural death, and I became my own selector and buyer of books. But it did go for many years, and it was an extraordinarily effective way of getting kids to read, I think. Even the most challenging sort of novel, a different one, I was still very, very keen to get through it and, and enjoy it, and I always did enjoy it, I think. They were very diverse books. The Puffin children's novels were, some were adventure stories, some were set in foreign places. One of my favourites was set in Ceylon in, you know, three or four centuries ago, and they were set all over the world. They were very often translations of world children's literature.
And you always did it. You never felt that it wasn't such a good book, but you wanted the next one, so you never cheated?
No, I never did. No, I always read it, and I think I always enjoyed it. And my father was a self-educated man, and books had been for him the key to discovering the world and really advancing, you know, into from having left a school at the age of 14, from becoming a professional graphic designer you know, greatly changing his situation in life. And so he very well understood that, you know, books were really the key to opening up worlds, and it was really vitally important for children to do that at that critical age.
Was he a big reader himself?
He was, yes. He was particularly interested in 20th century American writing, Steinbeck and Erwin Shaw and people like that, but he also read a lot of European literature, yes.
Now, you've actually amped this up a bit, because you've gone from a book a week to a book a day.
Oh, yes, this is very true. Once I started to work and had my own income, I would go on buying at least a book a week. But I found that just kept on growing and growing. And I guess I don't go out each day with the intention of buying a book, but very often I'll find myself in a bookshop and I'm buying five or six or at least three. And so I know that it averages, it certainly averages a book a day.
Now, do you read them all?
Second-hand bookshops. I certainly cannot read a book a day. No, I can't make that claim. A lot of them are books on art and architecture and photography and so on. So a lot of those books I'm buying as much for the images as for the text. But it has reached a point of, I have to confess, irrationality. I'm buying more books than I can really deal with. And I can blame my father entirely for that, of course.
It sounds like, to me, like a glorious addiction, Carl.
Well, it's definitely a form of addiction, yeah. It's a sort of compulsive behaviour, yes.
I would love to do that. Now, the books, though, that you're buying, and I know that you mentioned you spent some time in the visual art field.
Yes, I worked in art museums for 27 years, yes.
So these are sort of coffee table books.
Well, some of them are. Some of them are large books.
Rather beautiful books.
Many of them are, yes, it's true, but many of them are quite modest in size and scale, and they're very, very, very diverse. Yeah, but novels are still, I suppose, the core of my buying. When I say novels, I'm including there really biography, autobiography, and so on as well. But I reserve about 2 hours a day for specifically reading books of that kind, and I go to a cafe local cafe to do that, have several cups of coffee and read, and it ensures that I'm not my day at that time is not interrupted by phone ringing and household chores and other things. Mm. I'm now retired, so I have the time to do that.
Carl, I want your life from what you're saying.
It's pretty good.
I mentioned that some of these books are coffee table books. If you've got a lot of coffee table books, you need a lot of coffee tables.
Yes. Oh, yes. Indeed, flat surfaces are vitally important, absolutely required. So, yes, I'm always looking for more, and I did go out and found a very nice small-sized table, which I liked very much, and bought two or three of those, and then six. And I did end up buying 28 of those tables, yes.
Do you have a big home?
I'd say a bit bigger than average, yes.
Right.
Yes.
But a lot of the floor space is taken up with these tables.
Oh, it is, yes.
Yes.
And it still presents a problem. I mean, I do find myself very often putting books into large plastic boxes and then taking them down to the cellar just where I know they'll be safe, but not necessarily easily accessible.
What about bookshelves?
I'm always trying to buy fit in more bookshelves, but within the apartment itself, I think I've come to... I could build more bookshelves, but it means I have to take paintings off the wall, and that's a difficult choice to make. So I'm always trying to find ways of getting more bookshelves into other spaces, like a cellar.
How many do you think you have, Carl?
I've never really counted. I'd take a guess at something over 6,000, 6,000 to 7,000, perhaps.
And do you know where they all are?
I group them not in an alphabetical way. I group them according to subject matter, really. There are books on 20th century architecture in one area and books on Renaissance painting and sculpture in another and books on Roman Empire somewhere else. And so, and with novels, I tend to group them in national groups. So I put Australian literature in one area, American literature in another, English novels elsewhere, and French elsewhere. So, yeah, I more or less know where to put my hand.
Yes, that's very impressive. Now, I understand your father's method worked a treat with you.
Yes.
But not your sister.
Well, no. Now, it's interesting... at that time, obviously, our father must have tried that with her. She's 3 years younger, and he didn't pursue it. I think she just wasn't responsive at the time. But interestingly, by the time she was in her mid-teens, 16, 17, she really became a voracious reader, and I think she outreads me now. So she's made up for lost time. But so, maybe it doesn't work with everybody, but in my case, it certainly worked wonderfully well. And I would really recommend to parents with young kids that they might try it. Of course, it wouldn't have to be every week. I mean, it might be every other week or it might be every month. I think it's the expectation that book will come along at a certain interval. That
sets this up.
Exciting. It's an event to look forward to.
Sets up this lifelong and I think wonderful addiction. Carl, thank you for coming on Life Matters.
It's a great pleasure.
That was Carl. I might try that on my kids. That was Carl. Andrew, this week's Meet the Listener guest. And books have shaped his life. 6,000 to 7,000 he thinks he's got. I am very jealous. Now, I just want to quickly read an email we got from the repeat of the talk back on handwriting. Your program on handwriting struck a strong chord with me. I was never a prolific handwritten letter writer, but now communicate much more frequently to more people by email. It's so much easier to send a quick and timely good luck with the interview today or hope you're feeling better type of message by email. I find ideas for longer emails can flow quickly, knowing that can be left in draft form and tidied later before sending. The beauty of emails is the speed in which they can be composed and sent, and the low expectation of the receiver about the quality of the presentation. It's a medium where it's the thought that counts. However, I love the intimacy and personal feeling of handwriting. When I recently started assembling old family photos to put in an album, the few handwritten comments on the backs of photos felt so precious, even more personal than the images. I realised too late that we have not intentionally kept any physical records of people's handwriting, my grandfather's exquisitely neat financial journals, or my grandmother's meticulous copperplate that was always written slowly, and with care. I have, as a result, given my mother a pile of old photos with a request for her to identify them in her own beautiful handwriting. This says so much about her to me, and I would never want to be without it when she's no longer with us. And that's from Linda. And coming up after the news on ABC Radio National, it's The Book Show, and here's Ramona to tell us what she's got.
Well, Gail Poole will join me, and she's written a marvellous book called Faint Praise, The Plight of Book Reviewing in America, and by extension, in the rest of the globe, I think. And we're also looking at some of Indonesia's most prominent extremist organisations and what they're publishing too.
Join Ramona straight after the news for that. Now, tomorrow on Life Matters, teens and lying, and a couple who sold their house to fund their educations. More as well, more of your letters too. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.